Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Business Brew. I'm your host, Bill Brewster. First and foremost, I'd just like to point out that I appreciate everyone that listens to this. I got an inbound message that really meant a lot to me, that somebody said that he's come to view the podcast as a chance to eavesdrop on a really interesting conversation at the table next to me at a bar, held by guys with whom I would generally be friends. So yet another voice out there saying, keep up the great work. And I just want to say thank you very much to everyone that listens. I hope to have more women on the pod so that it can be held by guys and gals with whom you'd be friends. And that particular compliment means a lot to me because that's actually the exact vision that I had when I created this show. And I hope that we can all continue to make something fun together and that it remains somewhat educational and somewhat entertaining. So just thanks again for tuning in and thanks to everyone that's participated. This episode is brought to you by Coifin. Coifin displays financial information simply and elegantly. Coifin is one of the fastest growing platforms for financial data and analytics to research stocks and understand market trends. Its interface is absolutely awesome. Imagine a Bloomberg Lite with tons of high quality fundamental data, a powerful graph engine that can show it all clearly, and the aforementioned interface that doesn't look like it was built in the 1990s. If you're an individual investor, research analyst, portfolio manager, or financial advisor, do yourself a favor and check them out. You won't regret it. Sign up for free at coifin.com. That's K-O-Y-F-I-N.com. This particular episode features Kyler Hassan. Kyler is a hilarious person, cracks me up. More importantly than that, well, not more importantly, but for purposes of investing, I find him to be very thoughtful, and I've enjoyed getting to know him over the past couple of years, and I've enjoyed watching him become a better investor, a better steward of other people's money, and somebody who's really open about how he thinks about things and areas that he could improve on. And I just hope that you all enjoy this conversation as much as I did, because I always love hopping on the phone, or in this case, the mic with him. He cracks me up. Great guy. And as always, none of this is financial advice. All of the information contained in this program is for entertainment purposes only. Please consult your financial advisor before making an investment decision. If you need a registered investment advisor, consider Kyler and do your own due diligence. None of this is investment advice. And with that out of the way, so Kyler, how you doing, man?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me on. Appreciate it.
Well, thank you for coming on. We've got the technical aspects sorted, and I just watched chug a box of bone broth, for lack of a better term. So you're ready to go.
Of course.
Why do you look so good right now? That's a question I've been wondering. I've seen you on your bike. What's going on with you physically? Are you intermittent fasting and all this stuff?
A little bit. I work out a lot. Like to ride my bike. Yeah, I don't know. I'm just trying to stay in good shape, eat relatively well. I'm like usually hopelessly addicted to sugar, so trying to stop that. I saw some guy, he had like a test, and he's like, hey, you know, we want to make sure you're not eating too much sugar. Here's 10 questions to see if you're addicted. If you answer yes on 2, then you're addicted. I answered yes on 9.
You know what? That happened to me for an ADD test.
Oh, good.
Yeah. They were like, if you answer yes to more than 4 of these, you probably have ADD. And I looked and I had like 8 or 9 of them.
Right. And you're like, well, I just have Twitter. So that's what's the difference?
Yeah, that's right. And then I was like, I don't even know if I answered the questions. Honestly, I wasn't paying much attention. I was focused on something else.
Yeah. Well, so hopefully, I have noticed my focusing abilities has gone down a lot as well. So that's good.
Because of Twitter, you think?
100%. Yeah.
Yeah.
My attention span's like 10 seconds.
So where did you start? Did you start writing on Seeking Alpha when you were a young investor?
Yes. I didn't write a ton, but of what I did write, I published it there. I wrote on a blog for a little while. You know, I figured it would be good to own my own content.
Yeah.
I know all the companies are doing that, so I figured I'd do it myself.
You were the OG creator economy.
Yeah, of course. I'm just going to catch up to Disney pretty soon, I think. So I started writing on a blog. I don't know if you ever try to use WordPress, but it's hopelessly difficult.
Yes.
It took me like 20 minutes to get my mic to work for this. So you can only imagine how self-publishing a blog was. That was pretty terrible.
For some background to anyone listening, Kyler didn't even get the mic to work. We had to call in the big dogs, also known as Kyler's wife.
Yeah, she's luckily much smarter, you know, in addition to prettier, more charming, etc. And tech savvy. So that's good. But yeah, no, so I wrote on the blog for a little while and then I migrated all to Substack because they do the back end for you. So that was much better. I've written one thing.
Yes. Oh, that's right. You wrote up Altice right on Substack.
I wrote up Altice. It was a good, it would be difficult to start writing somewhere and have the first thing you write about go down 40% in like a month and a half.
Yeah. It's one of those, you couldn't do it if you tried.
No.
Yeah. You know what I liked about the Altice discussion too, was you and Andrew Walker, I thought was a fantastic podcast. And I liked how it took about 55 minutes to say anything positive about the stock or the company. Like it basically was you guys ripping them apart for 55 straight minutes. And then
it turns out most of those minutes were right.
Oh, Lord. Well, sometimes that happens, man. I was caught in that one too. So I understand. I think I understand what you see. I don't know, man. What's the best way to tackle this? Should we talk about why Altice was the siren song that got you back into value investing bad ideas? Or should we talk about where you came from and where you're at? You choose. Good. You call it.
Well, I guess I could start with how I got started and that could maybe work in. I'm a registered investment advisor, but most of my business is portfolio management. So I have individual clients, I manage separate accounts for them, and they mostly have the goals of most individuals, which is, you know, hey, I've got some money, I need to do some financial planning, which I do up front. And then, you know, I just want to make a good return on my money. So that's how I operate. And I started investing in, I think, 2013, and over maybe 5 or 6 years made a bit of a transformation. I realized when I started, I literally just thought, hey, listen, I need to go out and I need to crush the S&P 500 or else people are just going to fire me. And that's not quite how individuals work, to my surprise. Maybe it's obvious on this side, but they generally want, for as much as I think about portfolio management, probably the most value I add to people are to make sure they set up their financial lives really conservatively without a lot of debt, all those things. And then make sure they don't do anything really dumb, which any kind of speculation, a lot of my more well-off clients, they see a lot of very high fee real estate deals come across their desk. We generally try not to do those. We do a good one, but I haven't really seen any good ones yet. Different startup ideas, all this stuff. And so the first thing is I really just try to make sure they don't do anything like explicitly dumb, which is harder than you might think. But then with the truly long-term money that they do have, the second piece is I just want to make sure it's mostly invested in productive assets for the long-term. And either that's they want to do some real estate themselves or they want to invest in stocks with me. They don't really care about a benchmark quarter to quarter. They obviously care about their returns over time. And that's what I really try to generate for them. And just by chance, I think I was fairly young when I started trying to raise some money, maybe the one differentiator I had compared to most other more experienced, better investors is that I could really personalize things for them. And I have a lot of clients that make some money and live in California. And if you live in California, your tax rates, especially marginally, are very high.
Yeah.
That can be 55% on short-term gains, 36 or 37, even on long-term stuff.
That's insane. I say this as somebody in Florida.
Yeah. I had one move to Texas and I was like, thank you.
And now I can start making decisions from first principles.
Yeah, exactly.
High turnover strategies. It's amazing to see how much tax drag screws you, which is something that I would do well learning a little bit from, and maybe just going back to Papa Buffett and hiding in Berkshire for a while rather than dicking around with some of these other ideas. You know, I'm getting the tax bill on Curate. I'm finally finishing my taxes. It's a pain in the ass, man.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a nice problem to have, but Pythia actually said this to me when I was pitching it, and he was like, look, man, it could work for sure, but the tax bill is going to be huge and not exactly rocket science, that he pointed out. And I wasn't really focused on that at the time because I was focused on how good the investment opportunity is, but the pain of cutting that tax check sucks.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And you live in Florida.
So yeah.
Just think of how much worse it would be if you're in California.
Well, dude, when I found it, no, that's not true. I was in Florida when I found it, thankfully, and I had already moved residence because I was in Illinois for the first half of that year. It could have been a lot different.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, I guess another way to say it is if you are a high net worth investor in California and you invest in a hedge fund and it turns over its portfolio once a year, say all your gains are long term and they make 20% net returns, you're making roughly 12 or 13 after tax. And obviously the difference between 20 and 12 or 13 is compounded over time is huge. So I think my strategy sort of changed a few years in when I realized, you know what, listen, I can buy a good investment in a good company and it can double. And after the tax I have to pay, if I want to sell it, once it hits fair value, it's going to take a big chunk out of my return. So then I realized, well, you know what, why don't I just try to buy things that, and I know this is sort of a bogeyman, but what if I can buy things that I can just plan on never selling? I can get the returns and I don't have to pay tax, and hopefully I can defer it either a really, really long time or just never pay the tax. I think maybe in 2018 or so, I really internalized that after buying some good, not great businesses and making some money and paying the tax and see how it hit the after-tax IRRs, and tried to move into, can I identify the 50 best companies? And by best, I mean very durable and should be able to grow for a long time. And I really like the microeconomics. I don't think competitors are going to sort of pop up. And so if I can own those kinds of companies and not sell them, then my after-tax returns, which is how I raised the money in the first place, telling my investors, hey, I can make you good after-tax returns, I can try to optimize those. Now I own a few good things and mostly don't touch them, you know, and then do some other things as well. But that's the base of it.
Yeah. I like that, man. I have a disease where I like cheap stuff. And the problem with saying that out loud is cheap is predicated upon what it's worth, and then the probability of realizing what you think it's worth, and then the probability of selling it at the right time when it hits what it's worth. It's a tough game. I need to be a little bit more comfortable just being patient. That would be my weakness and my Achilles heel, which is, I don't know that I'm unique in that, but it's nice to know that about myself. I got to go through the last 5 years of what I've done and figure out what my turnover is. I know it's part of me is hiding from it because I don't want to know the answer, right? But
yeah,
part of me knows the answer, which is why I'm hiding from it. So,
yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, I think it's a good point. It's like a lot of maybe old school value investing is I'm going to buy an asset that's worth a dollar and I'm going to buy it for 70 cents. Some people shoot for buying things really cheap, say at 50. Let's say you're buying something at 70 and you think it's worth a dollar and it'll take a year to get there. That's a, 40% return if you're right. But if you're paying all that tax, it's about 25%. So it's a 50% chance you're right and a 50% chance you're flat, then your sort of expected value IRR on that's about 12. So something that looks super attractive after you take the tax into account and pay full freight on that, it's like, well, if I can just find something that'll compound at 12 for a really long time, you'd probably rather just do that.
I mean, you're 100% correct. I think that the thing that makes me nervous, to be fair to myself, I have gotten much better at this than I used to be. A lot of the turnovers in the first 3 years, but I still have too much. Regardless, there's this thing in me that worries about being right for the first 3 to 4 years and then just getting like blindsided. So you take an asset like a Peloton, right? And I fully understand what that asset is today. And I think I understand where it can go in the future. But boy, if something changes, it wouldn't surprise me, right? So maybe the answer is, well, then you just move on to a different asset. But the only reason that I pulled that one out of thin air is I perceive it to be one of these really long duration, for lack of a better term, bets where the real bet is on the operating leverage on the back end of things. That stuff makes me nervous. I think I'd probably be better playing where I think you play, which is when S&P got pretty cheap when they had the acquisition going on. And it's like your current cash flow base gives you a margin of some protection. And then maybe there's a little bit of sizzle on top of that.
Yeah, I think that's right. It's a good point. I think where I try to get paid is years 5 through 10, 15, 20. S&P Global, our good friend Jerry Kapp, was in the process of buying IHS Markit, and the stock sold off a little, and it got not terribly cheap, but maybe close to a 5% free cash yield on the combined entity. And I was not of the opinion that that was a terrific deal for S&P Global. I think their credit rating business is like the best business in the world. That being said, I think they're going to do pretty well on it, maybe slightly worse than their business would have done by itself. But also it's like they went from owning S&P Global was one monopoly and three very strong oligopolies. And now it's just they have 8 or 9 monopoly oligopoly businesses. It's just like, sure, maybe they'll make a tiny bit less money, but on a risk adjusted basis.
Yeah.
You have 8 or 9 bulletproof businesses. I can see the appeal in that. And so as an investor, that wasn't one where I was like, well, listen, I'm going to make the hugest IRRs I've ever made in my life. But it was a lot of very, in my opinion, very durable cash flow streams that should grow over time. I think my IRR will be hopefully 10 or 12%, but for a long time. I feel pretty confident in many of those businesses that 20 years out, they're going to look pretty similar to what they do now. And, you know, if I can find that and it's something that I'm able to hold, I'm willing to pay up a little for it to get those after-tax returns in the out years.
Yeah, that makes sense. So, how do you think through mean reversion and how these oligopolies have shaken out? And I guess the real question is, I tend to think we may have entered a period where there's either too much regulatory capture or there's been too much consolidation. If I actually believe that there was a willingness to break that up, I'd be a little bit more nervous about mean reversion. But I think some of these oligopolies are kind of set. And I don't know that the market is worse off for it, to be fair. But I think a lot of if I'm looking back and I say, well, historically, these profit pools have been competed away. I don't know. How do you think through whether or not the profit pools are going to stay for 10 to 20 years? Or how do you monitor something like that? How do you think about watching these positions?
I'd say it's case by case. I'm a very, very bottoms up person. I don't have very strong top down views on anything. I think it's a very real risk to watch out for. I think it's interesting when you're looking at an individual business. It's easy to say, well, hey, I just want to own the best businesses and just leave it at that. But I think you have to realize that there is risk in everything. There's obvious risk in buying businesses that suck. There's obvious risk if you buy a super, super profitable business. There's competitive risk and there's regulatory risk. I don't think that you can hide from all risk when you're investing in a company. We could think of a million bad businesses and the rest there's obvious. But if you own something like a Google or an Amazon, that's a huge business that dominates its markets, you would be a little crazy to not think, well, hey, there's real regulatory risk here, and that's important to keep in mind. It doesn't mean that you can't own something, but you have to take it into account, I think. And then, of course, anything else very profitable, you need to worry about the competitive risk. So like TransDigm, you know, I've owned that for a long time, and their return on tangible capital is like 100% pre-tax or something close to that. Obviously, they charge high prices. And so if you're looking at that business, you just need to focus pretty much all your time on, are people going to come undercut them? All those worries. So I just think there's risk everywhere.
Yeah.
And you have to understand them and understand that nothing's bulletproof. I think sometimes I see investors are just like, well, it's such a great business, there's no risk. And it's just like, that's just not right. And if you can't figure out what the big risks are, then sooner or later, I think you can get steamrolled.
Yeah, you'll find out what the big risks are when they materialize.
Yeah. And like, you know, I think the big risk is, if I think something is no risk, then I'm going to put a shitload of money into it. And there's some risk somewhere. And sooner or later, something's going to happen. And you realize, oh, I took more risk than I should have. I think it's Howard Marks, that story. He's like, the horse bettor went to the racetrack and there was only one horse in the race. So he mortgaged the house. And then
the horse dies or something in the race.
Yeah. The horse jumps the fence. And so he loses all his money. It's kind of like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I own Google and I own a good chunk of it. But, you know, under the wrong regulatory environment, there's certainly some things that regulators could do to that business. So it's not like I have half my money in it.
Yeah.
I think you just need to be really cognizant and think really hard of all the ways you can lose. And in every single situation, there's plenty.
Something I've enjoyed talking to you about is your move towards a little bit more of a diversified portfolio. Because for a while, I think you were more comfortable with concentration. And I think we both sort of trended away from that a little bit. Obviously, short of an index here, but I don't know. I think that one of the scariest lines that I see people recite and recycle is when Buffett said, you know, I'd have 50% of my net worth in my favorite position. And I have always wondered if people that listen to that statement understand all of the assumptions he's making behind his favorite position. Right. Yeah. And I don't think Buffett would ever do that without some form of control.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
Like, I don't think Buffett's going to let 50% of his net worth ride on agency costs somehow. Like, that's not how you become him.
Yeah. I have actually a lot of thoughts on that. The first thing that I don't hear enough people talk about is, you're not nearly as smart as Warren Buffett is.
Yeah.
Like, not even close. Like he's the guy, he ran his hedge fund, and I think people forget, and he made like 30% net returns for a long time. He is, I think, the greatest investor of our generation or the last one or whatever. And I don't think it's particularly close. And so people are like, well, you know, Buffett says this and Buffett says that. And it's just like, you're not Buffett. You're not close to Buffett. And that's not saying anything bad about you. It's just the universe of people that aren't as smart as Warren Buffett is the whole investing universe. So
yeah, that's right.
So yeah, I think that's a good point on agency costs. I actually think the most impressive thing about Buffett's investing career is, I think he said after they lost some money on Tesco a few years back, he said, we've never lost more than 2% of book value in one idea. Maybe there were a couple cases, but it was because he used a temporary loss to put the money in Washington Post, which was a thousand bagger. So I don't think that counts.
Yeah, turns out he got out of that one okay.
Yeah. So, but like he has historically ran pretty concentrated. And to be an investor in the markets for whatever, 60 years it's been, and to be concentrated and to not lose more than 2% of your money in anything is really wild and is a testament to just how good he is. Clearly, there's a bit of survivorship bias there, right? There could have been a situation that he could have lost money and maybe it didn't happen. But still, I think that's quite impressive and speaks to his risk management. And probably that there's a lot of things that he could have done that he thought he was likely to make money on, but he didn't because he wanted to wait for something more with less risk or more certain.
Yeah.
I think that's interesting. But yeah, I mean, I think he says, you know, nobody ever got rich off their sixth or seventh best idea, or whatever that quote is exactly. And it's like, yes, that's true. But I do know a lot of people that got poor off their first idea, you know, like it's like almost everyone old enough.
Yeah.
Like a lot. How many stories, and this is sort of back to my day job as I manage money for people, and how many people, I was thinking about this the other day, how many people do you think have made positive inflation adjusted returns over the last 40 years when both the stock and bond markets have ripped? I don't know the answer. Maybe it's 10% of people. You know, I'm talking about like after fees and tax. It's not a lot, because there's a lot of pitfalls. And I think the biggest one is being overconfident and putting a lot of money in a stupid idea. I've just like, honestly, through thinking about all that stuff, and I have people and I want to invest money for them for a really long time. And if you can't blow up, if you blow up, you blow somebody up. And so if you're trying not to blow up, I think it makes a lot of sense to not be concentrated. It's maybe just sort of obvious. I just didn't think about it in the right ways when I was starting. Maybe at that point, I didn't know I was a lot dumber than Warren Buffett.
Well, yeah, I think too, you know, it's hard to read somebody that's like your idol, for lack of a better term, and then not want to apply the lessons that they're teaching. Like, to me, Charlie talks about being hyper concentrated and having, I mean, his portfolio was wild, right? And you can look back at that portfolio and say, well, Charlie had 40% drawdown, so I have to be able to handle them too. Yeah. Or you could say, well, maybe I don't need to have my bogey be making as much money as humanly possible. And my bogey can be just sort of getting to the end of the finish line, and I'll let the geniuses play for who's the smartest, right? When Charlie was putting up those returns, he was talking to Buffett like you and I talk, or, you know, like me and whoever else talk. Talking to Buffett would be a better use of your time than talking to me. I hate to say.
Yeah, it's true.
So, I know it's very sad, but it is true.
And vice versa, though. So,
yes. Yeah. So, you know what I mean? It's kind of like, I don't know. I think that people look at the career and the track records, and I don't know. It appears to me, at least with some of the people that I interact with, that a healthy dose of base rates and understanding of survivorship bias would probably go a long way.
Yeah, I think so. And I think one more thing. I mean, so one, I might be saying this a little bit wrong, but I don't think Charlie Munger was the most successful investor of individuals' money. His returns were great. And it might even just be he didn't want the stress of putting other people through drawdowns, which is fine. I don't know if it's like his clients were like, I hate this, get me out. Or I don't know what the situation was, but you know, he invested for people for 10 or 15 years, maybe. Perhaps not sustainable. I don't know. His returns were great. Not trying to knock those. But, you know, it's different than, like you say, having control of Berkshire and being able to do whatever you want. And I think, like you say, I mean, how many investors, really concentrated investors, do you know that have blown up with something? From earlier, you said we're not trying to use anybody's names, but there's a few big investors today that have had huge positions that they lost tons of money on, and some have recovered and some haven't. But you shouldn't use a couple people that have recovered to say, well, listen, if I've got a 30% position and it goes to zero, that I'll be able to recover from that, because you probably won't.
Yeah.
I took a class in college, and it was on decision making, and it was really interesting. Every question in the homework and the tests was multiple choice. And the way you did it was not, you don't circle A, you say, this is the probability that I think A is right. Hypothetically, let's say the question is 2 plus 2 and A is 0, B is 1, C is 2, and D is 4. You could pretty much say, well, okay, I'm 100% sure that D is right, because, you know, 2 plus 2 is 4. But with these harder questions, if you're really damn sure, you might put 95%. The way the class was graded was, if you put 100, I'm 100% sure that this is right and you're wrong, then you fail the class.
Wow.
You fail the class. Point being, you're not 100% sure, so don't put 100. Yeah, it was graded on a logarithmic curve. So if you had no idea, you'd say 25% for each and you'd get a little bit of the points off. If I said I'm 2% sure that this one's right and it is right, you're getting negative a lot. Huh. It was a way to, I actually need to put, you know, how certain I am. And of course, you know, 20.
Wow, dude, what a good class.
Yeah, it was really cool. And no joke, I got how many times, what percentage of times do you think I put 95% or higher and I was wrong? 10 or 15% of the time, right? Like way too much.
Huh.
It was really interesting. I think I got a half a letter grade worse than I should have just because of overconfidence. No surprise there, probably. I'm sure most of the class did. But it was just a really interesting way to think of, you know, how sure am I actually of something? And one thing I think about investing is if you're relatively young, you might have 40, 50, 60 years. And if I'm pushing the limit every year, I only need to be really wrong once or twice in order for my results to not be very good.
Yeah.
And I'm wrong, you know, I'm wrong on things with some frequency, as we all are. I never use leverage. I try to make sure my clients, like, they have big cash balances and don't need the money. I try to do everything I can to make sure we're going to survive. And obviously, you need to survive and do well enough for the effort to be worth it. But you have to survive first. If I have 50 people that invest with me, and after 15 years, they're like, well, hey, listen, we made 8% with you and we could have made 9% of the market. That's going to be okay.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't ruin a bunch of people's lives. If I zero their money or lose 75% of their money because I was an idiot, then that matters. And I have a bunch of people who are like, hey, this was, you know, for my kids to go to college and you fucked it up.
You know, this is interesting. I'm going to hijack this conversation and talk about what I want to, if that's okay. Yeah. I've been thinking about the pressure that I've put on myself to justify active management has been that I've got to outperform the S&P or else I'm wasting my time. And I think that that is creating bad decision-making in me. And I really like how you said that, right? Because at the end of the day, if I realize 7% and 9% was the return of the S&P or whatever, I understand how compounding works. I get it, right? But I've said it a number of times. The only thing that I have strong opinions on right now is that as a basket, these high-priced software stocks are risky bets, to say the least. I don't know that they're going to crash. I don't know anything about any individual company. I just think, historically speaking, you buy things at these multiples, it tends not to work out very well as a basket, at least over a 3 to 5 year time horizon. I don't know. People want to come at me about the Nifty 50. If you had just bought those 50 years later, you would have outperformed. Well, you had to live through a whole lot of underperformance. So there's a big assumption in being able to do that, right? So I think, to your point, doing something that your clients can understand and getting them to the finish line is the number one concern from a personal investing standpoint. Now, if you're a hedge fund manager, it's a completely different conversation, right? You got a different bogey.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that's one thing. I think a lot of people talk past each other. I invest a certain way because of what the people I invest for need. Like I said, maybe when I was just starting, I didn't quite appreciate that enough. But I invest the way I do because that's what my investors want. I've never raised institutional money. I presume that if I have money from 5 or 10 institutional investors and I'm long only and they invest with 20 people like me, they don't want my 10th best idea. Right. They don't want my 15th best idea. They want concentration. And so I think we can look at people's 13Fs and say, man, look at how concentrated they are. That's insane. Realistically, it's probably what their investors want.
Yeah.
I really try not to judge other people. I mean, listen, there's this older guy in my office. I joined this RIA a few years ago, registered investment advisor a few years ago. These guys helped me out with a lot of things. They're a little older. They've been on the street. They know some stuff and they were going to handle my back office was the main reason, but now we're good friends and we talk investments and stuff. It's been a great partnership. There's this other RIA, this guy that is there, and his strategy is he's got some sort of moving average crossover, right? He's like a trend following guy. He'll get in and out of the market from time to time. But when he's in, I literally think
he's all in.
He takes all the stocks and organizes them by highest relative strength and says, I'm going to own those. So we barely ever have any overlap. But I remember a couple times when something I've owned has been ripping. He's like, it happened with O'Reilly once, O'Reilly Auto Parts. I owned that for sort of a long time and it had just ripped. And I was looking at it like, if I could short stocks, I'd be short O'Reilly. And he's like, I just bought O'Reilly. Like, this thing's going to the moon. I'm just like, what? It's completely the opposite of what I do and how I think and what kind of risks I'm comfortable with. And of course, over 30 years or however long he's been investing, he's in his 70s. He's like smashed the S&P 500, just obliterated it. And you could say, well, hey, you know, he was out of the market in the great financial crisis. If you adjust, but that's what trend following is for.
Yeah, that's the whole purpose of what he does.
Right. So
that's like saying to somebody, well, you know, you didn't, they chip in out of the fairway and you're like, that doesn't count. You hit it in. And it's like, yeah, I know. That's exactly why I do what I did. Right. Or whatever.
Exactly. Exactly. Right. He's completely opposite of me. He's crushed the market. People can do well plenty of different ways. And I never want to think that my way is the best. People do things differently and that's fine.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that it's tough. We've referenced Twitter, right? So I think that both of us see a lot of stuff on Twitter and you see the tribes kind of talk past each other. And it frustrates me a little that some accounts that I perceive are just like sort of shilling momentum or whatever, gain all this following and the rah-rah around some of the stocks. Though I watched some of it happen with lumber and it's weird to know what's going on and have a view and then impute what's going on in other places that I don't know what's going on. So I think a healthier perspective is maybe just to say, I don't know and move on, right? Doesn't matter. I don't need to get involved with it. They can do their thing. I'm going to keep doing my thing. And that's how it's going to go.
I think that's right. I think we all have our behavioral biases and you can go online or read all the books and you can figure out 40 or 50. I've always thought it's a very personal thing. There's some, and I'm just like, I don't do that. And there's some where I'm like, I fall victim to this constantly. One of the ones I think I'm pretty good at is not being jealous of people if they're temporarily making a lot of money, or even if they make a lot of money over 20 years doing something I wouldn't. People make money in high growth software stocks. Maybe it's temporary. I don't know. Maybe they can continue to make money, but I just don't care. Yeah. I don't have the skills to understand some of these B2B software names where, to your point, you need to be given the valuations, you need to be right in 10 and 20 years. I don't understand them enough to do that. And so I don't care. People are double their money in the last, if people doubled their money in the last 12 months doing that, then that's great. And I wish them success, but I do something different, hopefully in providing value to the people I invest for. And that's kind of good enough.
What is one that you think you fall victim to?
Overconfidence is always a problem. I owned energy for a long time.
Oh, yeah. I sent you that message last night. And so did you even listen to the message or did you erase it from your mind?
I read what you said and didn't look up the ticker. I probably know what the ticker is, but I'm you know. It's funny because I told you the energy I owned and you bought some of it. And I think you've done probably okay, but it wasn't exactly a winner.
I still like the way you look at that stuff. I think midstream makes sense.
I think
the incentives suck in many of those, though.
I think, a good segue. I owned energy for a long time. I think the first thing I did was buy Exxon. Man, the years blend together. Maybe it was 2016, whenever oil prices were starting to go down, whatever Thanksgiving that was, that OPEC just was like, we're going to drill whatever. You know, it's interesting because looking back on that decision, I thought, listen, I need to own something that has good returns on capital because it's very capital intensive business. You need to make sure that whatever you're investing in, they're actually making good returns on what they spend. I want a really strong balance sheet because it's a cyclical sector. They might not be profitable every year, but I think if I can own something with good returns on capital and a conservative balance sheet and good management, then through the cycle, I should do okay. And I thought I was buying Exxon pretty cheap. Turns out their relative returns on capital advantage to their peers was in the process of disappearing. and the upstream business was harder than I thought. So that it didn't work out for those reasons. But the big sin, the big mistake, this was before I started diversifying more, is I owned like a lot of it. I think it was 15% plus position, maybe. It's easy now to be like, oh, that was dumb. And it was, but it was like some of this overconfidence problem. And then to make matters worse, a couple of years later, I said, well, I like these midstream companies. Exxon, I'd been tracking it and I was hoping they'd really invest through the cycle. They invest a lot of money when oil prices were low and they could invest at good returns. And their returns on capital went down enough that they just didn't have much extra cash flow. You can look in the late 90s, Exxon oil prices were really low and Exxon was killing it. And so they had all this leftover money and they could just invest at the bottom of the cycle and get all these good projects at good returns. But this time their underlying profitability wasn't high enough to do that. And so I was just like, the thesis is wrong. But oh, by the way, I really like these, was a few companies, but Magellan Midstream, they're the best operators in the space. Their management is legitimately very good. Most of their assets are really high quality and still are. They're refined products assets, which were over half the company. And so I sort of switched my stake in that and maybe a couple other energy infrastructure names. And the assets that weren't very good, the 30 or 40 other percent of the company, were a lot worse than I thought. And so I transitioned my money in there and the management is still great and most of their assets are still good. But now they're making a couple hundred million less dollars than I thought they would at this point. And the degradation of value comes straight off the equity. Didn't do very well in that either. And in both of those cases, if I would have invested in something with a lot more leverage or where the business was worse, I could have lost all my money.
Yeah.
So luckily I was smart enough not to do that. But if this was a 5% position, that would be one thing. If it's 15, then losing a little bit of money over 5 years while everything else you own, well, not everything, but the other companies you own are doing really well, it really impacts your performance.
Yeah.
And so I think that was the big mistake. I shouldn't have owned too much confidence. Realistically, I didn't know those businesses as well as other ones. And so that's probably the biggest behavioral bias I have that I'm trying to solve, like we talked about. There's others that probably matter less, but that's a big one.
I like that. People ask me, or people have said that talking about names creates confirmation bias or consistency bias or whatever. That doesn't really get to me. I do think, to your point, I think overconfidence is probably one of my biggest errors. I know that my biggest personal, my weakness is that I pull the trigger a little quick, which is why I will flip sometimes.
Yeah.
But I need to figure out the best way to determine whether or not the cost of that decision is worth the risk. My sense is that it's not worth the risk. And I used to be so into the idea of, well, if you buy something cheap enough, that's your margin of safety. And I'm morphing a lot to the idea that execution is your margin of safety. If I look at Altice, where I think that if I was going to pick apart the decision, I think that you and I both agreed that the stock was too inexpensive or cheap. If we had waited for some of the results that we were expecting to actually come through, does the stock double overnight? Probably not. Right. So could I have waited for execution for a better entry point? And it's something that, as I talk to more pros, they say you can buy things higher with less risk. And I have a natural aversion to that statement because I have such a perception of price being the margin of safety, but I'm starting to understand that statement a little bit better, if that makes any sense, right? Because I do think that if Altice specifically proves the theory that Suddenlink is there for not the taking, but they can execute in Suddenlink and they can start subgrowth again. I don't know. What's the stock rip? From here, maybe more, but from where we bought it, just seems to me like one of those things that maybe I'm a little quick. I'm rambling here, but I'm just going to continue. The idea of being long-term, I think sometimes I have bought something and I've said, well, I'm long term, so it'll work out. Where the real thought that would have been more accurate is I have time to wait because I'm long term.
Right. Yeah, exactly right.
And I think price is almost always driven that decision. And that's where I think I get screwed on value traps.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, the places I've made almost all my money, and I mean, honestly, thinking back, if I was to do some return attribution and subtract some things that don't fit this, it might be more than all the money I've made. It is just is realistically high quality companies that we know are executing that just sold off a lot for a non-core reason. I've made all my money like that. There's no real question. Charter a few years ago, people were worried about video. It was easy enough to go in and see video wasn't that profitable, if profitable at all. And so that was an encore reason. And they were executing plenty well on the internet side and they were growing. And Andrew Walker did a bunch of good write-ups just showing how cheap that was. And like, that was an obvious situation. They're executing really well. Business is doing well. Most of the time it's in that one, the market wasn't cheap, but most of the times I've done well is the market really sells off and something that everybody knows is good and executes well gets too cheap. Plenty of examples there, but I think you're right. Businesses are made up of people. They're not in a spreadsheet. If you're going to do the strategy that we are trying to do, you need to own the ones that are executing well. Altice, if it doesn't work out, it will be because they don't execute well.
Yeah.
And I'm more than happy to make the bet that they will and that they can figure it out. And that might be wrong. And it's a higher risk thing than I usually do. And it was luckily sized as such from the beginning. But you're right. It is execution. You know, I own, one we know well. In the fall of 2019, I bought Wells Fargo. And the thesis there was, look, their deposits are growing a little less than JP Morgan or Bank of America, but they're roughly in line, even though they have all these operational problems and they have so much cost. And so if they can just execute well, they're not losing the franchise in the interim and the costs will come out down the line. And if you assume costs sort of get back to normal levels, then your IRR on it was going to be like 15 or 20 years or something high. COVID happened and rates plummeted and all the banks sold off and you're worried about loan losses, all those things. So I think it went maybe I bought it 45 and it went to 20 or something in there. But in the meantime, and I remember you sent me, I don't remember exactly the date, but you sent me the document there in front of Congress and Congress was like, hey, you guys, we said you need to do all those things. And
You've done none of the things.
Like, stop stealing money from your customers. And they're just like, nah, we're just going to keep stealing their money.
Dude, it was crazy.
Yeah, it was really bad. And
the other thing that was nuts about that document is they were hiring consultants to tell them what to do. And then they were sending the consultants' plans to Congress as if it was their plan, but they had hired no one that was capable of implementing the plan and they hadn't actually even discussed it internally. It was basically like just like blowing money on consultants to do nothing with the information.
Right.
Part of me reading that report was said, I don't even know if this is nefarious activity. They may just be incapable of doing it because they just don't even have the organizational knowledge of how to do this.
Yeah.
Because they hired from within.
Right. That's why I think that's right. And I think what I got wrong was I said, hey, how hard is it to turn around a bank?
Yeah.
Maybe I should have thought about that a little more because it's a huge organization with all sorts of crazy incentive structures. And we knew their culture was wrong. And so who knows? Again, long term, that was only a couple of years ago. Maybe they'll figure it out. I don't really know. I was just kind of wrong. Like they weren't executing.
Yeah.
I think there's businesses that just continue to execute well and ones that don't. And you don't generally want to own the ones that don't. Luckily, when everything sold off in COVID, First Republic Bank, which I love, it is great. It sold off really hard too, just with all the other banks. And I had to pay up a little bit to switch from Wells to First Republic, but I did. And since then, First Republic is that they've just done a great job. They've really grown the business, great customer service and the whole thing. And I remember when I did the switch, I remember the math I did was, if Wells Fargo fixes itself, what's my return in 10 years? And then just what do I think I'll make in First Republic? And the numbers were about the same. So I was like, well, hey, listen, the upside's pretty similar. Downside with Wells is infinitely higher, maybe.
Yeah.
it was hard to pay up a little bit. That's one of my other biases is I grew up a value investor and it's sort of hard to pay up, but you just run the math on what you expect the returns to be and do what makes sense. And so did that. And now First Republic trades way higher than it should, but whatever, it's a compounder, so you
know. So never sell.
So never sell.
Well, but the thing about that is the execution can bail you out, I think. Like in the same way, and I think this is one of these statements that all good ideas can get taken too far, but in the same way that returns compound, I think execution and culture compounds. And there's a reason First Republic trades where it does relative to the rest of the group. Whether or not the multiple turns out to be justified or whatever, I don't know. But I think that when I was younger, I didn't understand that there were reasons behind these things. Now, the devil's advocate in me says, well, why don't you just say the same thing about SaaS? And the answer is, I'm perfectly fine admitting that I may be wrong, that SaaS is too expensive here, right? But I don't have to have a view.
Yeah. No, I mean, I don't. It's funny. I was looking at some really complex B2B SaaS name, and I don't understand most SaaS, but I was looking at it and I was like, they provide database software and they're used by the big cloud companies or through the big cloud companies. How am I going to know really what their competitive advantages, and you have to be right on it for probably 20 or 30 years to make money. And do I really think that I'm going to be able to understand their competitive position for that long? And if Amazon or Microsoft build something that's better themselves, do I have any idea on this? If there's somebody else comes in and builds a new one, I know the switching costs are high, but that's not enough for that long. And it's just like, I don't know, happy to skip it. I'll look at something else.
Yeah. So, yeah, I think that's right.
I think there's plenty of companies that you just sort of watch them over time. And there's a similar survivorship bias thing. Well, hey, listen, 5 years ago, there were companies that everybody thought were great and then they weren't. True. So I don't think this is an iron thing, but there's plenty of companies that you sort of notice they have the right culture for their industry and they just keep doing well. And probably they have some moat that helps. I think you can have good culture in a really hard business and it sort of won't matter. Or maybe you won't do super well just because the business is hard. But there's plenty that you just see what the people, how the people of that business behave themselves and the results they generate. And they just sort of get it. I'm looking at Amazon right now and I don't really know. But you look at the past, and you look at Bezos just talking about like, hey, we're taking prices down and we're going to spend all this money on free shipping and the customers will really like it. And so fuck it. We're just going to do it because we think it's the right thing to do. Not really sure, but just really customer focused. And obviously that worked out incredibly for them. I think it's the most important thing, maybe almost, but it's really hard to figure it out.
And what is culture, or what's the, when you say it's the most important, I just want to make sure I understand what you're saying. Are you saying culture or?
I would say culture blended with the ability to execute.
Execution. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, I think so. There's just another example. My dad's a painting contractor. They paint big commercial jobs. And most of those other companies went bankrupt over the last maybe 15 years. And a lot of them, 2009 happened and there was not that much work. And a lot of them just chased complex, low margin jobs and something went wrong and you're out of business.
Yeah. It's different, but that's how my father's side of the family had a huge construction business, and complexity plus I think a couple aggressive bids turned into bankruptcy.
Right. Yeah, and it's easy. And so, like, what do you have to do to be successful? Okay, yes, you need to know a lot of things on your actual business, but I think having a culture of, hey, even in that case, it's just like, hey, we're not going to do stupid things. That's what saved them. We're just going to be rational and do things that make sense. End of insurance can be like that too. A lot of cyclical things can be like that. But you have to have patience and not do anything for a couple of years and hopefully have a strong balance sheet, all those things. But it's the culture that I think really makes a true difference over the long term. Frustratingly for investors, it's the hardest thing to figure out. So if you can, then you can, I think, do pretty well.
It's funny when you're saying you need the ability to not do stupid things, patience, and a good balance sheet. That's pretty much what I think it takes to be a good investor too. Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And I struggle the most. I mean, I've said it now a couple different ways, but doing nothing is like not, it's a hard skill to learn.
I think where individuals have the biggest advantage, you don't have to report to anybody. Obviously, there's the Buffett saying about that there's no called strikes, but there's two ways to look at investing, in my opinion, like two big ways. One, you dollar cost average. You have some money, you invest it in your best idea, you try to blend it together in a good portfolio that's not taking too much risk or whatever. And that works really well. If you consistently do that over time, you're very likely to have a very good result. And the other way is money comes in, you put it in your brokerage account and it sits in cash. And then when you see a 25% IRR, you deploy it.
Yeah.
And I think what's really hard is a lot of the very best investors, that's how they operated. The very best ones with the best long-term returns. You can, like Berkshire, they made most of their money at market bottoms. Washington Post, Geico was like that when they initially bought it. Wells Fargo, when they bought it in like 1990, that was killed. Burlington Northern Santa Fe. Most of their big ideas happened at the market bottoms because they had cash around. I think what's, and there's some counterexamples there, obviously. But I think what's really hard is some of the very best investors, that's how they made all their money. But also I know a bunch of people who have been in 50% cash since like 2012.
Yeah.
Because, oh, feels the Fed and like all this stuff. And so again, it's that sort of survivorship bias. Like, what am I seeing with my eyes? Oh yeah, I can just sit around and wait for all those huge IRRs. But there's plenty of people that try to do that and do much worse than if they just dollar cost averaged. So I don't think there's a right way. I think there's two separate ways. Both can be successful. It's higher variance if you try to wait around. And also, it's hard to predict when you'll get the opportunities, right? We've gotten good opportunities every couple of years, but you can go long periods of time without anything. And then it makes it harder because you're like, well, I've been waiting for 3 years. And then maybe you're more liable to take an opportunity that's not as good as you should have because you're impatient. It's not.
Yeah, you end up stretching on an idea to get something done.
Yeah, and Buffett's done that too. I've done that. Probably Wells Fargo in 2019 was that. I had too much cash and I said, oh, well, this looks pretty good and probably shouldn't have done that one. I think in the same way that there's, you can't avoid risk, like I said, buying the best businesses compared to the worst. You can't avoid risk in this whole cash management thing either. Whichever way you decide to try to go, there's just risk everywhere and you need to try to be aware of it and make really rational decisions. And it's not easy for anyone.
Yeah. No, I think that's right. It's funny because I was naturally attracted to the stay in cash and then swing. I think now where I'm closer to being attracted to is have some core positions and then be very, very honest about what the opportunity cost of selling those positions is. What do you not know? Like, you know, not everything, but every new idea that I like, by definition, I like. And there's a good chance I don't understand what I don't like about it in the same way that I understand the stuff I don't like that I own. Right. So what's the appropriate spread to incur all those risks? And I think that historically, I probably have underappreciated what that spread should be. It should be a very high bar, I think.
Yeah, again, I feel like people sometimes come on these and they're just like, well, hey, here's the right answer. It's like, no, listen, there's no right answer. Your spread should be positive. If I think I'm going to make 10% on Constellation software from here and 10% on some new thing. But just say like the new thing doesn't have leverage either and it's really high quality. Assuming buying more Constellation software wouldn't make me too concentrated in it, I should go with the thing that I know better.
Yeah.
I think that should be perfectly clear. And is the spread 2 points of IRR for the new thing or 4? I don't know, but it's more than zero and you need to adjust for it. When I first bought Altice, what I was trying to do was say, hey, I think I'm going to make X percent IRR on Charter. So to own Altice, I need to think I'm going to make about 5% a year more. It's only been a few months. We'll see how things play down the line. It hasn't worked out so far yet. But I think the idea is right. And Altice operationally is not as good. And so I think you need to try to make an adjustment for that as well. But I think you need to try to take into account.
Yeah. I have tax law sold Altice. We'll see whether or not that is a mistake. Historically, it has been a great contraindicator. So that's your inside tip. So we'll see. I don't know, but that's the crappy part of getting involved in a situation like that is the decision on Charter, is it a little stretched? And the decision there is like, oh well, do I want to live through this? Should I tax loss sell something? I actually do get a real benefit from short-term losses. Livium Capital has asked me this a couple times, and I think it's the right question to ask. He likes to go at my beloved curate about this, which I will not accept because that is the greatest thing ever. But even if the idea is right, are you introducing the possibility to mismanage the idea or the position? I do think some of that question underestimates what can go wrong in other investments. That's easy to say now about Altice. This isn't a game of 100% hits. So I don't know where I fall on that answer, but I think it's one worth pondering a little bit.
Wait, what's his question? Can you rephrase
that? So he asked, he basically said, why don't you just own some stuff that you think are executing a little bit better? And I mean, specifically, his take is big tech, right? And my answer was like, I think these have a reasonable probability of outperforming big tech. Mm. And I don't think you're going to fight multiple fade. I think you're going to benefit from multiple expansion over time, which is real. I think it is objectively a lot easier to own Google, which I've now owned for 4 years or so.
Congratulations.
Well, thank you. But you know, it's just easier to own, right? It's arguably the best business that's ever been created, and it's maybe never been the best performing stock in the market, but it's always... You can see intrinsic value building over time. You can see what they're doing. Other bets is a pain in the ass, but they've got a little bit of religion on that. And it's just, you can sleep at night owning it. Now, is that a toppy thing to say? I don't know, maybe, but I think people have been saying that for a long time and Google has proven people wrong. We'll see if it continues to do so in the future. Yeah. So is it easier to just close your eyes and buy something or hold something like that? I don't know. Terry Smith, I think, is a great example of a guy who is very, very good at holding and very, very good at being very dogmatic in what his definition of quality is and only getting in a pond where he thinks he can own these businesses for a very long time. And there's some merit to that. I mean, look no further than his record. Acri too.
Yeah, I think... It's a hard question, and like you said, maybe it's a toppy thought. I was talking to your good friend and my new friend, Jake Taylor, a couple of weeks ago, and he's talking about, well, hey, let's try to make some predictions and see how often you're right, like me in that class. Like, oh, 95% sure, but for some reason, that answer is only right 80% of the time.
Yeah.
That's weird. longer-term predictions, I think about this a lot. There's not really good feedback loops in investing.
Yeah.
The good ones are you get zeroed, right? That's a feedback loop. Like I invested in this and I got zeroed and bummer. But as far as even start 3 years ago and say Google's done well, but
people did not like Google back when I was buying it at all.
Yeah.
They didn't hate it necessarily, but it was like, what are they doing with other bets? They've got no capital return program. What's going on here? They're not focused. And now story's changed.
Yeah, story's changed. I don't think you can just say, well, hey, listen, over the past 5 years, AMT, there's a good one. Over the past 5 years, AMT's done so well. Why don't you just buy more of that? And it's like, well, listen, their revenues have mostly fixed escalators, and the ground leases underneath the towers have inflation-based escalators. And right now, nominal and real interest rates are super low. So if rates were up instead of down, you could have gotten killed on that. That's just one example, but there's a million examples out there of people. You can't just say, oh, it's been 3 or 5 years and I made the decision to buy this stock and not own that one, and it's worked out for me, so that was the right thing to do.
Yeah.
There's plenty of alternative histories out there where that didn't work out. And I think in this case, if you're trying to be first decile all the time in performance, that way of thinking can be really dangerous. You can say, well, hey, what did best off the March 2020 lows? And you can be like, oh, I should have bought a bunch of leveraged shit. And yeah, you would have made a lot of money, but imagine, I mean, I know this can be hard, but imagine like the Fed didn't save the world or things got worse. Like, you could have lost all your money like that.
Yeah.
I really try not to even let a few years of performance tell me, oh, this was a good decision or not. And I mean, honestly, like, let's say you started investing in 1982, interest rates have gone down the whole time you've been investing. Arguably, I think that would be bad experience to have. I don't think it's, oh, well, you've got 40 years of experience. It's like every year, pretty much, that you've been an investor, rates have gone down. And so all the things you think you've learned, not all of them, but a lot of them, are just a function of the most important macro variable going one way. Maybe we shouldn't try to draw all these hard conclusions. I think about it for myself, like the last 5 or 6 or 7 or however many years, anybody who's bought dips has done pretty damn well.
Yeah.
And so anytime there's a dip, I'm conditioned to be like, oh, I need to find something to buy. So it's like, you know, the market rips up 100% and then it goes down 5%. And I'm like, oh, I need to buy something. And it's like, well, maybe not.
Yeah.
If real rates really start moving up, there's a lot of things that are very expensive. I think you need to have a lot of humility and not overfit lessons, because, again, you don't get those hard feedback loops. You don't know what would have worked if the environment was slightly different. That's another argument for not being too concentrated. You learn all the wrong lessons and you concentrate into what you think are good ideas. And then the environment changes and then you're dead.
Yeah.
So, again, it's hard. It's really hard.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think the really, really good investors, when it's all said and done, are the people that could get through different environments and survive.
Right.
And I don't know how much of that requires changing strategy or how much of it just requires discipline. I'm not really sure on that answer. It definitely requires ever evolving, I think.
Yeah, I think we've watched some value investors that have done really well in the early 2000s be a little dogmatic. And again, I'm pretty hesitant to draw conclusions. It's a little easier if somebody ran long short and it was long value and short growth. I think they're just maybe completely impaired. But like, let's say you're long only and you own a bunch of value stocks and maybe you've underperformed the last 10 years. I think that's okay. And I think if the environment looked different, they could have maybe done a little better, you know, maybe worse in some cases, but probably in most of the alternative histories, done a little bit better. But that being said, I follow a lot of high quality businesses, and I can tell you without reservation, almost every single one was very cheap at some point over the last 6 or 7 or 8 years. I don't care what you're looking at. Visa was maybe 15 times earnings in 2011. Constellation Software has been pretty cheap, even in the last 4 or 5 years, a few times, even in a higher rate environment. You can just go down the list and you can see really high quality stuff that wasn't expensive. And I, you know, it's funny. That's another one of my biases was on the Google thing. I had a friend almost to the day of the COVID low. We own a lot of similar things. He said, hey, do you own Google? And I was like, no, I don't. He's like, why not? I was like, I don't know. Like, good question. My wife works there. We sort of own a lot. Is it really that good? And he was like, have you actually looked at it? And I mean, I'm not really kidding. I looked at it for like 2 hours. And I was like, huh. I thought it was maybe 18 times trailing earnings. Turns out with some of cloud losses, it was less. And I remember thinking, well, hey, it's 18 times earnings. It's really durable. I really like it. I'm just going to buy it. And so then after I did that, I was thinking, you know what? Google's minus whatever it was, 25 or 30% from before COVID. And there's a lot of things that I look at that are minus 50. And I'm buying Google. I'm buying the one that is relatively less attractive than a lot of the stuff that's lower quality and with leverage and everything. Why is that? Why was I buying other things instead of Google when they were less attractive relatively? And I realized I just had a mental block of buying anything at over 20 times earnings.
Yeah.
When you say it out loud, it's like, that's the dumbest thing I've ever heard.
It's not unique, man. I think a lot of people suffer from it. I have suffered from it.
Yeah. It's not unique, but it is dumb.
Yeah, I mean, that's right.
What we're trying to do here is discount the cash flows. And if it's above or below 20 times earnings, is that a hard rule on what the discounted cash flows are? What's net present value? No, it isn't.
Yeah. Especially in a business with that kind of potential for growth reinvestment.
Yeah. There's not a lot of businesses I pay that much for, but there are a few.
Yeah.
It's hard-headed to ignore them. Obviously, you can listen, the right business at 100 times sales, you can make money on. Don't know any, but hypothetically, you could.
Yeah.
I think you're trying to remove those blocks. You notice you have a block and you try to remove it. I don't even remember what the question was when we started, but
doesn't matter.
I remember that.
This is where we're going.
Yeah. I also, in late 2018, the market sold off pretty hard. And I had a similar sort of idea. I owned Brookfield at the time and it had sold off, and Constellation Software also sold off, and looked like real rates were going higher, and that would have really hurt Brookfield's business. Don't tell anybody I said that, but it's true. there's a lot of leverage, and they, whatever. Anyways, it would have hurt their business. And there's a lot of leverage there, and Constellation didn't have a lot, and Brookfield was down more. And I bought Constellation. It was the same sort of thing. I was like, I think my returns are going to be very adequate, and there's very little risk. So like, why am I going to do the riskier thing to make a little bit more money when I can make plenty here? And then again, I'm thinking, well, shoot, if I'm not buying all the levered, really beaten down stuff when the market's down a lot, and it's a more attractive, hypothetically, I shouldn't be buying it when the market's sort of at a normal level. I shouldn't really be buying it at all if I don't want to buy it when it is most attractive. I think ever since then, I used to own a lot of things with a lot of leverage. Now I own a few, but much less, just realizing that those mistakes I'd made mentally.
Yeah. I'm thinking through, I mean, obviously hard to talk about Curate and say you don't own stuff with leverage, but I think generally I try to partner with people that I think know how to manage leverage, which is why a lot of the leverage in the portfolios at Liberty, I think Right. Those guys get it.
Right.
And to be fair, a lot of women over there, those people get it, is what I should say. Yeah, I don't know. It's interesting. I think that Pythia had commented that every time he has thought that something is priced in, that has been a dangerous thought. And I do agree that I've gotten in trouble by thinking, I think maybe the most accurate way to interpret his comment and my experience is, when I say something is priced in, I probably need to dig deeper into what I'm missing so that I can actually have an informed view of what priced in means. Because yeah. I think I was fortunate enough to go out to Peter Kaufman's day, and I don't know that I 100% agree with what anybody says, but his concept of win-win-win, I think, makes a lot of sense, right? And I think that if I look at business decisions that I have made that have been justified by it's priced in are usually businesses that are not win-win-win. They're usually undergoing some sort of problem, and I'm usually overlooking the problem because of the odds. And I think that that's kind of like going to the track and seeing a horse that has a cut on its foot and like walking gingerly and then saying, well, I'm getting good odds. And it's like, all right, well, that horse isn't going to win, bro. Like, there's a reason those odds are the way they are.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's true. You know, I think a thought exercise is really good here. Like, what IRR do I need on this to own it? And I base everything on opportunity cost. I have a sort of a minimum, but I say, hey, listen, I can go buy Berkshire. There's no leverage. There's a lot of cash on the balance sheet. It's really diversified. It's really high quality. It's run almost annoyingly conservatively. And I think I can make 10% on that a year and never pay any tax. So I'm not going to do much if I don't think I can even make 10. The way I do it is like, well, okay, if I really like the business, really, really like the business, and I'm okay with some leverage on it. But if I'm going to buy something with leverage, I need to make more, right? So say 12 or 13 or 14 or whatever. If there's some operational risk, to your point, I need to make more. And I think you just need to ladder all these risks and increase the IRR you need to be interested. And so I remember looking at Altice and being like, okay, like what do I actually need to make here for me to want to own it? And my answer was 20% a year. And that's maybe comically high to some people. But also the way I underwrote it wasn't, oh, it's going to go from, I don't remember what the multiple was, but 8x EBITDA to 10x. And so I'm going to underwrite the multiple expansion. It's like, no. If I was going to buy this whole business and own it, I need my cash on cash returns when I take the growth into account, and I need to make 20% a year. And I think what's interesting is the price you pay in those circumstances is very low. Obviously, doesn't mean it can go lower. And if there's a lot of leverage like there is at Altice, sometimes it does, and that has. But I think going through the exercise sometimes can be a little surprising if you're really thinking through all the risks, the incremental risks you're taking, and you try to pay yourself for them. Sometimes you barely pay anything for something. And then on top of that, I would say you understand it's a higher risk situation like Altice, and my sizing is going to be a lot different, right? There's no world in which Altice is 10% of my money at cost, right? Like it would be for something really high quality, like a Constellation Software that I like. So I think you just put in all those safeguards and hopefully your analysis is right and hopefully it works out, and maybe it's not, but there's plenty of businesses that I like. And I look at them and I say, what would I pay for them? And it's like half of what they trade at. And it's just like, I'll probably never own it, but that's okay. There's other ones you can own. But it's an important exercise to go through. And obviously, doesn't mean you never lose, but you should be, I think, doing those things in the first place.
Yeah, I agree with that. On Constellation, I have some questions for you, if you don't mind.
Yeah.
So something that I've been thinking about is why in its terminal state would Constellation not kind of look a little bit like Altria? And what I mean about that is if you have a segment where your organic growth is negative, I know that Mark in the past has said, well, that's sort of a function of how they run the business. So I think that maybe my underlying assumption is not fair, right? Maybe that's a choice. How do you think through? So for people that don't know, Constellation is a software company that is a serial acquirer. They're very, very good at acquisitions. They're very, very focused on returns on capital. And the guy that runs it is, I mean, the closest thing to Buffett meets software, I think, that I've ever encountered. Not that I'm a savant, but I think he is, right? So, but a function of their strategy results in some negative organic growth. So how do you think through what that business looks like in a terminal state and how many acquisitions they can make, like going forward? Does that make sense?
Yeah. And let me just start off by saying, I'm not sure how well Constellation will work from these levels. I own it. It's between that and Topicus, which was recently spun off, one of their six business units. It's my biggest position. Not sure how well it's going to work. It's more expensive than it has historically. on that question specifically, I would say that when you're looking at the organic revenue, what you really care about is the maintenance revenue. They have some other hardware, which usually shrinks. The most important thing is the constant currency organic maintenance revenue. And that's usually a little positive. And I think the last, don't quote me exactly on this, but I think the last 5 years, their total organic revenue growth has been 0 or 1% per year. And the maintenance has been like 3. So they grow a little, which is a lot better than shrinking a little. And one other thing is, like you mentioned, they buy some things in runoff. So they buy some businesses where they say, well, hey, listen, the revenue is going to go down, but we're going to be able to make what we think is an adequate return on money even with that. So I would guess if they stopped doing acquisitions tomorrow, which they won't, but if they did, their organic revenue growth would look a little better. There's also an argument to be made that their margins would go up, which I don't assume. And I don't assume their organic revenue growth gets better either. But the way I think of the base businesses is just, I think they're low organic growers. In my head, I think 0 to 2% sort of thing over time. And maybe that's a little conservative, maybe not, but that's kind of how I view it. So I think the good question is the run rate free cash flow to Constellation, when you take out the non-controlling interest, it's like $1 billion a year. And the market cap's $35 billion right now, or right around there. And so what is a collection of really moaty businesses that barely grow worth? I don't know. I would say depends on your discount rate. But if your discount rate's 10 and you assume they grow 2%, then you're going to pay $12.5 billion for them. And if you assume they grow 0, you're going to pay 10. And so it's like, market cap's 35. And the base business, maybe you say, whatever, your discount rate's 8. Maybe say, I'll pay 15 times free cash, whatever. The base businesses are worth between $10 and $15 billion. And the whole business is worth $35 billion. So there's a bit of a gap.
Well, like
slightly.
Yeah, yeah.
So
this has been part of my issue, because I'm trying to figure this out, right?
Yeah.
Because I don't know. Because I've thought something similar, where I've been like, okay, even if, say, it's software, right? So maybe I don't require 10. Maybe I only require 7.
Right.
Right. If you think it grows 2, you're still not that much higher than a 20 times free cash flow multiple, right? So just kind of like...
still 15 what, billion short. Yeah.
Yeah. So like, what am I missing is what I'm trying to figure out. More than... And I don't even mean it from a stock perspective as much as I mean it from a business perspective. Because there's obviously... That 15 billion, the market is saying that's their acquisition ability, right? That's what we believe they're going to create via acquisitions in today's dollars.
Right. Yeah. So Mark Leonard asked their AGM a few years ago. They had an analyst come, and Mark Leonard asked him this question. It's like, why the hell is our stock so expensive? I think at that point it was 25 times earnings or a little higher, or free cash flow. They're about the same here. And I was like, well, the Fed and the this and the that, and you sort of circuitously got to the answer. But the real answer is the 10 years, 1.5. These businesses, it's almost a misnomer, like a misnomer to be like, oh, they're software businesses. They're just very moaty B2B businesses. They are oligopolistic. The total addressable markets are very, very small. I think they own one that it gives you your software to book a tea time. You know, just like really low.
I like it. That one I'd pay a lot for. And then else would be able to book their tee time, and I'd have all the tee times. As long as you're talking about golf and not actually sipping tea.
Yeah, right. Exactly. They're very moody. They're the sort of businesses. I really like these. And there's high switching costs, because if you rip out your mission critical software, it's hard to operate your business. So I really like these businesses because they're just like, if you run them well, you will succeed. If you can't operate them well, like we talked about, you can lose customers and your churn's going to go up and your results aren't going to be very good. But if you operate them well, and Constellation is, I would say, are good operators, you take the prices up a little every year and they're going to grow a little bit and they're very, very durable. So like, what kind of return should you earn on a portfolio like that? Say 7%. It's low risk. They're unlevered mostly. you shouldn't need to make a lot. That's how you value the base businesses. So whatever, say 15 or 20 billion if you want to use a low discount rate. But then the second thing is they've done, their acquisition machine is really interesting. I don't know of another company like it. Most companies or funds, maybe you start out with not that much money. You do some acquisitions. If you do well, you raise more money or you just get bigger. And then you do bigger acquisitions at lower rates of return. And the cycle keeps going and you use more leverage. And basically, you go from doing small acquisitions to really big ones. And the returns on those are just not going to be as high. Constellation, they have tons of people all across the organization looking for really, really small deals. And the capital markets are really inefficient at this size. Like, we're talking like $1 million of EBITDA, and you know, they'll buy them for like 4 or 5 million, maybe. Well, maybe even a little less. But really small deals. There's tons and tons and tons of these software companies out there. And so they've shown an ability to do $500 million a year, maybe $400 to $500 million a year of really high IRR acquisitions that are really small. They earn something like 25% returns on these. So just say they deploy $400 million, they get $100 million of free cash flow. We just talked about what's the cash flow worth. Call it 15x. 20 is too much, I think, but call it 15x. So they put out $400 million. They get off $100 million of free cash flow, they get $1.5 billion in value. So if they just do this every year without growing, they're adding $1.1 billion of value every year. The net present value of that without growing, discounted at 8%, is that's like $12 billion. And so I think what happened over the past few years is the market realized, hey, wait a second, they've scaled this organization. They can do a lot of this M&A really consistently because there's a lot of targets. And we think the net present value of that M&A ability is like maybe somewhere in that range, $10 or $15 billion. And I think that's why the valuation has come up. And now they're starting to try to do some bigger stuff on top of the small things that will come in at lower returns. And I hope they're successful. And I think they will be. Like, Mark Leonard he's really, really sharp. If you can listen to him talk ever, you should. I had an opportunity to stand with 15 people and ask him a bunch of questions a few years ago at the AGM. And he's, I don't know, he might be just as smart as Buffett, honestly. I came away really, really impressed. But they're going to look to do some bigger stuff, and I'm sure that'll add some value. But when you can consistently put a lot of money to work at like 25% IRRs, it's worth a lot. And they've shown the ability to be able to do that. And they'll probably be able to do it for a long time. So I think that's why the valuation's expanded, and given where rates are and everything. So it'll be interesting to watch. Hopefully, I hope they can keep growing at a good rate. Obviously, it won't happen forever, but I wouldn't be shocked if they just kept being able to add value for a long time.
Yeah, that makes sense. I got to have you do one more thing and then I'll let you get out of here. Can you explain the difference between what TransDigm does when they acquire a company and then sell off units versus the difference between when Comcast acquires a company and then pays down debt?
Yeah. Yeah, Brian Roberts couldn't stop this interview. He tried. He tried Comcast internet earlier today, but we fixed it.
He torpedoed it, so now it's time to take a shot back at him.
Yeah, we can't be silenced. Yeah, you know, it's really important to understand how companies fund M&A. And I don't think everybody gets this right. So TransDigm, whatever, I don't want to, you know, talk about the whole business, but the numbers are pretty clear. They tend to acquire stuff around 3 to 4 times revenue and then get the EBITDA margins up to 50% a few years after. And if you know anything about TransDigm, at a consolidated level, they use 6 turns of leverage on their EBITDA. So if you're just really quickly trying to figure out how accretive these are, you'd say, well, okay, if I buy something for 3 times revenue, $300 million, and it's got $100 million of revenue, then TransDigm's going to get $50 million of EBITDA out of that. So they acquired it at 6 times EBITDA, and they use six times of EBITDA leverage. So once they get the margins up, they're going to take all the equity that they put into the acquisition, they're going to take it out. So in that case, those cash flow streams are worth something like 15 times EBITDA. So it's like, I spent 300, I ended up getting $50 million of EBITDA, and I'm going to have $300 million of debt on it, and my equity is going to be worth $450 million. So they just created $450 million of value at that 15 times multiple, and they pulled all their equity out. That is, not many places can do that. I'm not really aware of any other ones. But then there's many companies that will acquire something with debt, and then they're going to pay the debt off. I think people will say, well, hey, listen, that's one example, like the Sky acquisition. Operationally, it didn't work out, or hasn't worked out very well so far. There's plenty of companies that acquire something good and they use all debt. And people are like, oh, wow, they're going to make they bought it, it's a 5% free cash flow yield, and it's growing 5%, and they bought it with all debt. So like, they're making 10% a year and they use 2% money. How obvious is that? And I think what people miss is, if you pay the debt off, then you just used equity.
Yeah. Or at a minimum, you've deferred your free cash flow to common equity by paying down debt, right? Your opportunity cost is very real because you are then paying down debt. So
yeah,
it's different.
Yeah. If anybody doesn't follow this, go do a discounted cash flow model and assume I buy something for $100 today using all debt. And then in year one, I pay down all my debt with the other cash flow from my company. I have $100 of cash outflow in year one, which I could have used to buy back stock or pay dividend or whatever. And then I get all the cash flow from the company over those years. You can still make a good return, but you should not be fooled by Roper's done this. They bought this company, Vertifor, and they're like, oh, it was all debt. And like, you run the math, and if you thought that it was going to be a 10% IRR with all the debt they used up front, and then when they paid it off really quick, it was like, it'd be like 11, or maybe it was 12, but not, oh, it was free money. There's differences.
Yeah.
Some people, they acquire stuff, and it's sort of about how much leverage you have on it at the end. And that it's all important, but that's, I think that's the most important thing. So it's a good model to have in your head to actually map out when the cash is going in and out.
Yeah, it's the difference between free cash flow to the firm and free cash flow that's available to common equity. And I think there's a lot of people that miss that those two things are quite a bit different, and free cash flow to the firm can be used to pay down debt. And if you're using it to pay down debt, it's not coming to the equity, and you got to discount that back in order to figure out the true value. It requires some thinking, and I think you're one of the people that spends a lot of time on serial acquirers and M&A generally, and I like how you look at it. I think you got a good handle on it. So I thank you for giving people a little bit of a lesson.
Yeah, I try. I'm somehow probably wrong. The math says what the math says, but in this one case, the mathematics just doesn't work or something like that.
Well, we'll say that you're 65% sure you're right. And I'm 100% sure people should do their own damn work. So,
yeah.
So
yeah,
there's
I'm 100%
that.
Sure I'm right. And then I just failed my investing class.
Well, that's all right. I'll fail it with you.
Yeah.
So, Kyler, thank you for joining me today. I appreciate it, sir.
Thanks again for having me on. Really appreciate it. And thanks for having all the famous people on before me so that you'd have a big audience by now.
Well, that's my goal. I'm basically, and then I'm going to continue that, and then you're going to come back on.
Okay, sounds good. But it's absolutely necessary.